This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Hello and welcome to a bonus edition of The Bunker, coming to you from deep within a carved out rock dwelling beneath the harsh, baking deserts of Islington North. I'm Andrew Harrison. Dune Part 2, the second installment of the desert science fiction saga that was once considered unfilmable, has just registered $200 million on the worldwide box office. Casting Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya as the nobleman turned rebel leader Paul Atreides and the indigenous fighter Chani has done the movie's commercial pull no harm whatsoever. But Denis Villeneuve's visually sumptuous adaptation has also brought to the fore the many political issues woven into Dune by its creator Frank Herbert. This is a story of imperialism, oppression, rebellion, commerce, monopoly, feudalism, militarism, Islam, jihad, and the perils of charismatic leadership, as well as giant worms and psychedelic spice. It's so full of contradictory themes that the original books have been both celebrated and denounced by everyone from the anti-imperialist left to the traditionalist right. The movies have even been eagerly awaited by actual online fascists who somehow see the brutal, racially uniform House Harkonnen as the heroes of the story. I love the Dune books. I devoured them as a teenager, and I love the movies too. So there'll be no better time to dive into the politics of Arrakis, the rebel freeman, and the whole Duneverse. Warning listeners, there will be spoilers, so if you're going to go and see the film but haven't seen it yet, maybe save this podcast for later. Here with me is novelist, head of the English department, and professor of 19th century literature at Royal Holloway University, and enthusiastic Dune fan, Adam Roberts. Hello, Adam.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me on. Like you, I obsessed over these books as a teenager. I read them over and over, so I'm very excited by it.
Excellent. It made us the men we are today, for exactly. Good or ill, half sandworm. So, firstly, well, just purely at the entertainment level, what did you make of Dune Part 2? I mean, the great thing about it is it just starts absolutely 2 seconds after the previous movie. Did you enjoy it as pure entertainment?
Oh, I did very much. Yeah, no, it's a masterpiece. It's extraordinary. I mean, it's very loud if you see it in the cinema, which is where you should see it because you want the scale of a big screen. It dinned my ears a little bit, but that's probably me getting older. But no, it's a magnificent piece of filmmaking. It really is. Having said that, there are more places in this sequel where it diverges from the book than was the case with the first Dune movie. And I found myself niggling away at that a little bit as I was thinking about the movie afterwards.
This is why Shai Halud gave us sequels.
Yes, exactly.
To explore these ideas. So let's start with the roots of Dune. The writer Frank Herbert developed it in the late 1950s and early 60s, kind of mixing his interest in the Oregon dunes, where he'd been living and visiting, certain Native American mentors that he would correspond with, and particularly a fascination with and fear of messianic figures. It first appeared as a serial in Analog magazine in the 1960s. It's common, Adam, to think of this as basically the space version of Lawrence of Arabia, in which we kind of look at the arrival of the Mahdi or the savior from the outside world. Is it as simple as that?
I'm not going to say no, although we have to concede that he's clearly been very influenced by David Lean's movie. I think it's why the spice turns your eyes so blue.
Because but you look like Peter O'Toole.
Peter O'Toole's eyes are so extraordinarily sapphire blue. And the whole narrative of this effectively white man coming into this Bedouin community and fighting imperial aggression gets translated into science fiction. But as you say, he had the idea for Dune long before he saw Lawrence of Arabia. His first novel was a submarine novel called The Dragon in the Sea, sometimes called Under Pressure, which was released in 1957. It's really good, actually. A kind of science fiction, near future war of the globe where resources have become so depleted that submarines are going to steal oil from undersea oil reserves that the enemy have, a very high pressure, very difficult job. And it's a book about kind of claustrophobia, about all these people crammed into this little machine and how they interact with one another. And having finished that, he was still working as a journalist, so he picked up a paying gig to go and report for the Oregon newspapers on the Oregon sand dunes. So the Oregon sand dunes had been a big problem in Oregon. They were blown by the wind and they accumulated and they rolled over communities. They swallowed houses. You build a wall to try and stop them. They'd simply go over the top of the wall. And they were eventually, that problem was solved by fixing the dunes with special grasses that are happy to grow in sand. And they put the roots down and they keep the dunes solid and they stop them rolling across the countryside. And he was just really fascinated by that idea, by the ecological solution to the real world problems that he saw all around him. And it set him on a path to become more and more of what we would nowadays call an environmentalist. Mm. So 1957, he doesn't actually write Dune until the mid-60s. And it's, as you say, it's published in, first of all, in the science fiction magazine Analog, 64 to 65, and then published as a standalone novel in 1965. And it's a slow burn, but it soon becomes a really big success. It wins science fiction prizes, and it leads him to write other Dune novels. And there are now dozens and dozens of Dune novels, most of them written by his son, Brian. But the point I suppose I'd make about that is, unlike almost everything else that Herbert wrote, there's something really spacious and open about Dune. Most of his other novels are, he's fascinated by, you know, cities that have billions of people living in them and everyone's cheek by jowl, or people having to get by in a tiny little submarine or in a tiny little spacecraft. And those books are sometimes a bit uncomfortable to read, whereas Dune is kind of wide open, this huge desert world.
So how to concentrate on the politics of it, that kind of post-war vaguely orientalist idea that is now roundly condemned as the white savior thing, It is quite core to the entire, it is the spine of the Dune story, and makes it very interesting that it should come out now when these things, as a movie, when these things are so much more discussed in the mainstream.
Yeah, and some of the ways in which Denis Villeneuve and his team have changed the novel, I think, are to the good. So there's much more of a focus in the movies on how the Fremen live, what their culture is, many more scenes set in that world. In the original novel, Fremen's are kind of a backdrop to the core story, which is, you know, the fall and rise of Paul Atreides after his father is murdered and his family is destroyed. And that's the real focus of it. And that is in the novel, which is a period piece. It's from the mid-1960s. It is a piece of Orientalism, I think. And it is Lawrence of Arabia. It is a white savior coming in. And they're trying to shift the center of gravity of the story in the movie. Inevitably, it is always going to be about Paul, but there's more of a sense that the Fremen are kind of fleshed out in a real culture.
Yeah, I certainly got a strong sense that Chani and Stilgar, they have more centrality, they're more realized. And actually, the way that we see Stilgar, his mentor and his friend, who effectively saves him and vouches for him and is his entree into the Fremen life, goes from being a friend to a worshipper.
Yeah.
And the love of his life, spoiler, I'm afraid, Chani, is discarded and relegated to concubine so that Paul can marry Princess Irulan. Politics trumps humanity. And it's kind of, they're not backdrop. They are, his relationships with them absolutely define what he has become.
And just in terms of the politics of it, the movies are much more explicit. This is kind of in the novels, but not really. But in the movies, Chani has a speech where she says, well, you know, you're a duke's son and you come from this hierarchical world, this feudal world, which is all, you know, up and down. Whereas in the Fremen community, everyone is for everyone. It's a kind of communism, actually, yeah. In which, you know, they all are equal, men and women both. And that's not really in the novel, I have to say. But I think it's a good thing that it's being kind of spun in the movie in the way that it is.
Yeah. One key theme is that Herbert, and he was open about this, he hates and fears the notion of the superhero, the messianic figure. The story in both the initial books and the two movies end with charismatic quasi-mystical leadership producing a genocide. Billions will die because Paul, having feared and rejected his destiny, then throws himself into it enthusiastically. But effectively, it's a story of a secular figure Paul Atreides, a nobleman, becoming a quasi-mystical figure, Muad'Dib, who saw the freedom fighter. What's that telling us about the way Herbert saw the world, but also saw that kind of relationship of oppression and freedom that's fictionalized in Dune?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? It reminds me a little bit of, and it's a very different sort of a text, but it also had an important role in my teenage years, 2000 AD's Judge Dredd.
Oh my God, you are me.
It's true. But Grant Morrison would say, you know, we invented a fascist. It was a critique of fascism. And then the fans just love him. Mm. I think with Dune, it's hard because Paul is a very compelling character. And the narrative arc of that first novel, which is what the first two Villeneuve movies have now put on screen, is a very compelling story. His entire family is destroyed. He's alone in the desert with nothing and nobody. And yet he manages to come back. So at the point that the novel certainly ends, I think it's a little bit more ambiguous in the movie, but at the point where the novel ends, he seems like a hero. He's gone on a classic hero's journey and we're sort of rooting for him. And I think what Herbert thought was, you're quite right, he was intensely suspicious of that kind of charismatic leader, particularly someone who presents themselves literally as a messiah. So the remaining Dune novels that Herbert wrote are repeated attempts to remind us this isn't a good thing.
I wanted to ask you, though, do you think that the fact that we watch the movie within the framework of our understanding of films and our understanding of the kind of narrative arc, and we've watched hundreds of these heroes' journeys, we're kind of on the rails of what we expect to be an action movie. Mm. Does that trap us even more effectively into being suckered into the idea that this is a hero's journey when actually it's the creation of a monster?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know how to address that because the action sequences in the movie are very exciting. Mm. And it's the Star Wars problematic, isn't it? That the climax of Star Wars is you blow up the Death Star. It's called the Death Star. It's a planet killer. You blow it up. That's great. But then you think there will be thousands, tens of thousands of kind of engineers and administrators and cooks and people living on the Death Star that you've just wiped out. It's a kind of strangely kind of scrubbed clean vision where it's just the pyrotechnics, it's just the fireworks that are so pretty to look at. And there's a certain amount of that in Dune too. I mean, it's interesting, I think, to compare it with Lawrence of Arabia, where Lawrence is quite a strange character and is never kind of heroized. He's eccentric and bizarre. He's very driven and determined and he achieves amazing things. But the end of Lawrence of Arabia as a movie is kind of Lawrence's failure. He succumbs to his violent side, which he's been struggling against. He commits atrocities. And then at the last analysis, he's unable to do anything to help the Arabs and just has to kind of retreat.
Looking at the world of the Dune movies, the thing I remember being really struck as a teenager with the idea, firstly, that the future was so strongly Islamic in tone. I think it was the first place I ever heard the word jihad, which appears in several contexts in Dune. The idea of the holy war, the holy struggle, which in the movie Paul triggers at the end, although it's actually not explicitly described as a jihad, but the concept runs through the book.
They call it the holy war, don't they, in the movie?
And essentially, viewed in 2024 as a Hollywood movie, we are being asked to watch a jihad from the point of view of the jihadis and that they should be our heroes. That is quite a challenging thing for a modern Hollywood movie.
And that we get scenes that, again, aren't in the book, where we see what it's like for the Fremen to be on the receiving end of the Harkonnen's superior technology, flying through the air and bombing their sieges and killing their men, women and children. And that's quite graphically rendered. And it's very hard, you know, as you say, in 2024, with everything that's happening in Israel, Gaza, not to see this as a kind of commentary on a particular current situation. And I suppose the movie's been in production for many years. This is, in a sense, synchronous, adventitious, it struck me very much watching it in the cinema. I can't have been the only one who's thinking in those terms.
Yeah. Well, you sent me an interesting blog post you'd written a while ago about Dune, not in a political sense, but in the sense of how relevant the world building is. Everybody loves science fiction, has a complicated relationship with world building. Does this world work? What are its precepts? What are its physical foundations? And I had an interesting quote from the science fiction writer Samuel Delaney, who said, science fiction is a radically metaphorical literature because it aims to represent the world without reproducing it. As in, the world of Dune is not a find and change copy of our world in which spice is oil,
yeah,
the Fremen are Arabs or the Fremen are Palestinians. It's not as direct as that, but there are certain resonances. Can you talk a little bit about that, about the kind of the way fantasy can sometimes be more realistic, perhaps, than straightforward representation?
I could talk for many hours. I'll go on and on about this because it's, when I write science fiction and I write about science fiction and I still love science fiction and still read it, and I think this is the heart of what I love about it. There is, I think, in the best science fiction, a transcendence of ordinary reality, but it works through metaphor. That if Isaac Asimov is writing robot stories, they're kind of stories about intelligent robots, but they're also stories about slavery and apartheid and dehumanization and how we treat our fellows. And I love that Delaney quotation, that metaphor can be more expressive and can get to the truth of things more effectively than simply, you know, realism or mimesis or books that just reproduce rather the world in which we're already familiar. And in Dune, I think the world building was, even in the 60s when the books came out, fans who often are very good at this kind of thing, spotting inconsistencies and infelicities in the way that your world has been put together, pointed out problems with Dune. If Dune is an entirely desert planet, if it has only the bare minimum of, there's a couple of palm trees here that are being maintained by being watered by a watering can, that's not enough vegetation to oxygenate the atmosphere. So there would be no oxygen in the air and everybody would die. Frank Herbert responded to that, and in later books he says, "Oh, well, you've misunderstood. The sandworms fart oxygen, and that's where all the oxygen comes from." And you're thinking, "No, you don't have to do that, Frank. That's not necessary. You're not creating a scientifically accurate representation of what life would be like on a planet that was entirely desert. You're producing something much more powerful, which is you're dramatizing and rendering a metaphor for the vastness of the world, for the sublime nature of what we encounter in the world out there, I think, for a certain kind of desolation." I've had arguments with fans as well, because it seems to me that the opening scene in the novel, which comes a little bit later in the first Villeneuve movie, is when the Bene Gesserit, the Reverend Mother, tests Paul by holding the Gom Jabbar, this poison needle, by his neck and saying, "You put your hand in that box, and if you take the hand out of the box, I will kill you with this needle." And inside the box, he feels intense pain. He believes his hand is being burnt and destroyed. It's not. It's just a kind of nerve impulse to test to see whether he has the willpower to keep his hand in the box. And he passes the test, and that's where we start. Now, the Reverend Mother in the first chapter of Dune says, this is because an animal would go to almost any lengths to avoid this. Only a human being will have what it takes to keep the hand in the box. And it seems to me that at that point, when he's writing the story, Herbert is thinking, okay, well, I've got a whole sandbox here to play with in two senses of the world. I've got a universe I can invent. I think I'll have some of the people, actual human beings, and some of them will be animals in disguise in some way. And then as the story goes on, I think he dropped that idea, and it's fine. He doesn't need it. He doesn't need it to explain why that scene with the Gom Jabbar is so potent, why it works so well. And I remember reading it as a teenager and being absolutely gobsmacked by it, because it seems to articulate something kind of really important about persistence, but about the disparity of power between adults and children, about the kind of irrationality of the world, about suffering. And it's really effective in that.
Mm. Yeah. Look, we're talking on International Women's Day, so we should talk more about the Bene Gesserit, the female order of mystics stroke witches who direct galactic history. The kind of attitude to sex, gender, and femininity in the books is really interesting, isn't it? A huge part of what makes Paul able to become who he is that he can walk both worlds, I think, is the quote. He can break on through to his female side. And yet Frank Herbert has an interesting attitude to femininity and what he would, you know, probably in quite a dated way, imagine to be the female psyche.
Yeah, it's another way in which the books haven't necessarily aged very well. I mean, the Bene Gesserit are fascinating, and the power behind the throne, but the throne is a masculine throne, as a male emperor, and the heads of all the houses are men and so on. The Bene Gesserit, or the Bee Gees, as I like to call them.
Well, they are staying alive.
Well, they are. So they have this generations-long breeding program where they're going to produce the Kwisatz Haderach, and Jessica has short-circuited that by having the power within her own body to decide to have a son rather than a daughter, to please her partner, who's not, they're not married, but she's the concubine of Duke Leto, and he wants a son, so she produces a son, and he has that power. But it is, you're right, radically a female power, that this exclusively female, I mean, what are they? They're a kind of Bene Gesserit. It sounds a bit like Jesuit. It sounds like a sort of female and a Catholic group that are particularly dedicated to the advancement of their faith.
Yeah. The kind of linguistic slide where sort of Islamic and Christian terms get kind of melded and confused is really an interesting part of the kind of ambience of Dune, isn't it? There are lots of resonances. The key religious book is the Orange Catholic Bible, which seems to contain a huge amount of Islam.
Well, it does. And so it's both Protestant and Catholic kind of amalgamated together. And it's quoted quite a lot in the book. Mm. There's also a kind of what's supposed to be a sort of kind of Buddhist Islamism, which is what the kind of behind the Fremen kind of integral culture, although the Bene Gesserit had been working for a long time to convince the Fremen peoples that their Mahdi, their savior, is now coming from off world and it is Paul. So they're kind of manipulating people. And I think that, and again, that's something that it's in the books and it's brought to the fore by the movie quite well, I think, is the extent to which we believe that Paul actually is a kind of messiah, that he has political powers, he's persuasive and he rises from nothing. He's just, at one point, he's just in a tent with his mother in the desert and he has literally nothing. But by the end of the movie, he's conquered Dune. He's leading all the Fremen. He's going on a holy war that will conquer the galaxy. So he's politically clearly very skilled. Does he also have kind of magic powers because he can see the future, because he can do various things that you or I couldn't do? I can't speak for you. Perhaps you can, but it would be beyond me.
I am the Mardiva podcast. you specialize in 19th century novels, full of dukes and counts and things like that. This is a feudal world, much pre-19th century, great houses, counts, barons, various kind of orders behind the scenes. Do you see a resonance with Dune and with the stuff you read in your day job?
Yeah, it's kind of an old-fashioned novel. It's sort of written in a lot of science fiction is actually. A lot of science fiction is written in a kind of traditionalist 19th century mode. It doesn't do kind of James Joyce experimentation with prose particularly. Mm. Sometimes you'll find that in science fiction. But I suppose the logic there is, you've already got quite a lot of weirdness and unfamiliarity in a science fiction text. If you then write it in a kind of weirdly experimental prose, that's one weirdness too many. And it's also the logic of the world itself, the story that Frank Herbert is telling. So there's been the Butlerian Jihad in the distant past, and the Butlerian Jihad is called the Butlerian Jihad after a Victorian, actually, Samuel Butler, who wrote an essay that was published in the late 19th century that was quite popular once upon a time, in which he said, well, machines are getting really quite sophisticated now, aren't they? I wonder if there'll come a time when they will supersede us. And that was the first iteration of an idea which 20th century science fiction becomes quite fascinated by, which is that machines, they're stronger, faster, more enduring, they might well be cleverer. What chance do we have against that? So in the backstory of Dune, there's been this Butlerian Jihad, which has smashed all the machines and made it illegal to have any kind of computer, any machine that replicates human thought. So instead of that, they have these sort of human computers called mentats who've developed super mental powers and can crunch numbers and do sums and so on.
We see them very briefly, don't we? We see them very briefly in Dune Part 2 orchestrating the Harkonnen attack on the Setch.
We see them a bit in Dune 1 as well, but it's a lot of it. There's a lot of that in the novel. But that means the novel is sort of a pre-industrial novel, and that takes us back to this feudal world. Herbert had specific ideas about feudalism, which I don't know if they were right, actually, but this is what he thought. He thought that a feudal culture was the way politics shaped itself in a world where it was very hard to travel from A to B, where communities were generally isolated from one another. So he thought that was, you know, medieval Europe was feudal. But he also thought that in the earliest American settlements, before the railroads came in North America and linked up communities, before kind of modern Americana, that was also kind of feudal, kind of puritanical and so on. And I don't know if that's true, but that's the universe he sketched out for Dune. So it's very hard to get from planet to planet. You need this incredibly valuable spice. Your spacecraft needs to be piloted by some weird mutant space pilot who has absorbed a great deal of spice, because the spice enables them to understand the complex folds of hyperspace and steer the spacecraft through. They're called highliners.
Yeah.
But because spice is only produced on Dune, it's very rare and very valuable. It's very hard and very expensive to get from planet to planet. So that means all these settlements and communities are all kind of isolated from one another. And in Herbert's logic, that means you're bound to have a sort of feudal social structure. I don't know if that's, is that right, do you think?
Well, I don't know about the feudal social structure, but what you do have is you have space travel in the hands of a monopoly, which is the Spacing Guild.
Yeah.
And they employ all the, or possibly consist of all the navigators. They buy and control all the spice, except spice is only produced on Arrakis, so who controls the spice controls the universe.
Yeah.
But basically, interstellar travel is entirely controlled by a guild, which is quite, it's not exactly feudal, but it's certainly pre-industrial revolution in that every main trade had a guild, which basically ran as a closed shop. What I find really fascinating about the Dune universe is that the kind of economics sort of work. You know, it's not just mysticism and it's not just feudalism.
Do they, though? I wonder about that. I mean, the thing that sometimes puzzles me about Dune is because so much of the focus is on Arrakis, where there is very little, you wonder where any of the water comes from. You wonder how the planet gets oxygenated. It's incredibly barren. And there you think, okay, so scarcity economics clearly works here because, you know, water is so scarce that you can't even just let a corpse be buried in the ground. You have to extract all its water before you can dispose of it. That scarcity works in that environment. But presumably that's not the case for most of the worlds across the known universe. Once you expand beyond a single planet, I wonder if scarcity is even a thing anymore.
Well, I suppose scarcity isn't just the existence of stuff, it's the access to stuff.
Yes, I suppose.
So we know in our own solar system of vast quantities of precious metals that we could absolutely use, but we just can't get to them. And even if we had a gigantic mutant spice navigator, we'd find it pretty tricky to get to them anyway. Just in closing then, I mean, we talked about the representation of real world things in science fiction, whether they're metaphorical, whether they're kind of direct analogues. Is it just too arid and reductive to say, you know, the spice is oil and Fremen are the Arab nation? Does it sort of rob the fiction of its ability to play fast and loose with these things and introduce new ideas?
Well, it's not only oil, is it? I mean, I think that is a way of understanding what's happening, that this is a kind of re-dramatization. And in that respect, it does fall into some of the pitfalls we were talking about earlier with the Orientalism. And it's also worth mentioning, I think, that in the novel, it's much clearer that Baron Harkonnen is kind of another kind of Orientalism. He's kind of a Russian baddie. He's also kind of villainous, but he's coded sort of Russian. He's a baron. He's not a duke, and he's got this strange surname, and he has all these kind of Orientalist kind of caricature aspects. He's very greedy and very fat, and he's gay, which was quite a thing in the 1960s, but now looks just homophobic.
Yeah.
But that's also part of the logic of Orientalism, that the world was the West and the East. And that was written at the time, just at the beginning, really, of not just the environmental movement, but the oil crisis that then dominated the 70s when several of the Dune novels came out. It's hard not to see that as a context. But the other thing about the spices, it doesn't just power your car. Your car is a spaceship. It alters your consciousness. It changes your mind. It's a sort of transcendental religious signifier as well. So I would say another context for a novel published right in the middle of the 60s was the counterculture, LSD, this idea that we could use pharmaceuticals to literally expand our consciousness and get in touch with the divine and the doors of perception. And I don't know if we still believe that, but that had quite a large footprint through the 60s and 70s, and not just in science fiction, but in popular music and in kind of various countercultural iterations. And that's also what The Spice is, isn't it?
Yeah. It's interesting to me, the more I watch the films and the more it reminds me of the books I read in formative years, it made me realise that Star Wars is basically the heavily decaffeinated Dune and the Bene Gesserit are the they're the proper full-strength Jedi. The Jedi are just kind of slightly weak and wimpy and also male without the kind of Machiavellian aspect that the Bene Gesserit have.
Yeah, I think that's right, isn't it? I think Herbert understood the religious impulse and... I mean, it's at the moment it is quite finely balanced because Paul is, for most of the movie, is saying, "I'm not the Messiah." I mean, that's the people have been said, putting out memes, haven't they, saying it's a bit Life of Brian.
Very Life of Brian. Got a lot of laughs when I watched it.
Yeah, I'm not the Messiah. And yeah, so that there's the Herbert's careful to put in a kind of material explanation for anything that looks like a miracle. So when Jessica drinks the waters of life, she should be poisoned and she should die, but she lives, and that's seen as a miraculous sign that she's a reverend mother. But in the books you discover, and I think it's mentioned in the movies, that the Bene Gesserit have the power to control their physiology and denature any poisons that they ingest. So she's just done this kind of clever trick and made it look like a miracle. But as the books go on, the miracles become less and less easy to explain in terms of, you know, a notional materiality. They become more and more straightforwardly religious. And it'll be interesting to see how the movies proceed with that.
It certainly will be. Adam Roberts, thank you for this fantastic nerd out, which I've enjoyed enormously.
Oh, we have nerded, haven't we? We've super nerded.
We totally have. Listeners, we do hope you have enjoyed this little bonus outing. And by the way, if you want a bonus, if you support our partner podcast, Oh God, What Now? On Patreon, then there is another small Dune extra coming on Monday in our supporter extra cast, which is called Oh God, What Else? I talk to fellow Dune fan and Bene Gesserit witch Marie Leconte, just purely about the movie and how much we enjoyed it. In the meantime, join the Bunker Patreon. That was me doing the Bene Gesserit voice. You have no alternative but to obey. Thanks again for listening. Salamaka alahu wa nazaraka. May God protect you and grant you victory. We'll see you next time.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Andrew Harrison. The producer was Eliza Davis Beard, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. Music was by me and Amory Leader. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. The group editor is Andrew Harrison, and artwork is by James Parrott. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.